Welcome to the Number 10 Podcast. Hello. This episode is dedicated to Martin Soanes and John Orman. I'd also like to thank all of you listening who have been chasing me for a new episode. Thank you for your patience. I've had a really busy few weeks, well, months now, with the real world including two unfortunate bereavements, a new job, as well as a few months ago our chief mouse, Juno, going missing. Luckily she has been found and Mrs. Number 10 has her on lockdown. Well, we're all on lockdown really, aren't we? She's not getting along with Piper, our newest cat, but these things do take time. We also haven't found a good ministerial title for her either. Answers will be accepted on the back of postcards. Mrs. Number 10 is well, and has successfully refused all attempts of me pulling her into my lockdown gardening adventures. She has, however, rewatched many episodes of Hell's Kitchen and a multitude of documentaries. Despite this, whenever I pipe up with a fact, she doesn't want to know. I think we've all had a few tough months, and I hope that this episode brings you a bit of relief from the mundane of 24-hour news and lockdown. My best wishes are with you and your families at this frightening time. It takes a lot to faze me, but I've been pretty okay through all this until I went down to the supermarket towards the beginning of lockdown, with security guards on the doors, a one-way system, and everyone in masks. It was uncomfortable. When I got back to the car, I had to take a moment to rationalise it all. And I'm sure we will get through all of this and, follow the rules, stay at home, stay alert, depending on which province you're in, and help each other through as much as possible. Virtually, of course. The recent protests over George Floyd and all the young black men who have lost their lives at the hands of police force has highlighted a huge problem in how we approach race and equality. Seeing the statue of Edward Colston felled in Bristol last week as I approach the slave trade in this podcast has certainly made me think about how I will cover the topic and do it justice. Of course, I am aware that the slave trade existed before where we are in the podcast, but as we're really just doing an overview for context, I don't want to dig down into it until we start talking about the Royal African Company, the East India Trading Company, and the Golden Age of British trade dominance about 40 years from now. The statistic that really hit me this week was that the sixth most common cause of death for young black men in America is death by police force. And that's pretty powerful, isn't it? It has certainly made me think. Anyway, back to the history. So we've had a break and we've done quite a bit of political stuff over December and the last year, so I want to concentrate pretty much exclusively on our historical narrative and push on to our first Prime Minister. So today we'll be talking about Queen Anne, then a bit about King George, and then we'll be on to Robert Walpole. And although I was keen to move on to Walpole, our first Prime Minister, before our 1 year anniversary, that unfortunately has passed. But we will get to him very soon. To start talking about Anne, we need to go back to the 1600s. Prince James, who became King James II after Charles II died, had two children. Princess Mary was the daughter of James with Anne Hyde, who would later be married off at the age of 15 to William of Orange, who would then go on to depose James II in the Bloodless Revolution of 1688, which we covered, also known as the Glorious Revolution. 3 years later, in 1665, Princess Anne was born. Out of the eight children that Anne Hyde had, only Anne and her older sister Mary survived. Anne was sent to France at the age of three to receive treatment for an eye disorder known as defluxion that caused her eyes to water excessively. This would be the first of many ailments Anne would suffer. And not long after she returned in 1671, her mother Anne Hyde died of breast cancer. James remarried to a Catholic devout known as Mary of Medina, also aged about 15, only 4 years older than James's daughter Mary. Now, we know that Mary was married off to William of Orange, and so too was Anne to Prince George of Denmark in 1683, as James, along with his brother Charles II, had defeated their enemies involved in the Rye House Plot. Anne and the Prince Consort, as we know, supported the revolution against her father in 1688, led by her sister Mary and her husband William of Orange. This really was a family affair when you think about it. Anne was a strong Protestant and stuck to that despite James II being heavily Catholic after his marriage to Mary of Medina. Now, we talked about the Act of Settlement in 1701 that forbade the ascension of a Catholic to the throne. It was the death of Prince William that sparked Parliament to enact such a measure. Now, we've spoken in detail about the reign of William and Mary, and as we know, William followed his wife Mary to the grave in 1702 after breaking his collarbone from a horse stumbling into a molehill on the grounds of Hampton Court Palace, situated in what is now southwest London borough of Richmond-on-Thames. William was not greatly mourned, and that's because he wasn't widely loved. For many, he was the least worst option at the time of the Glorious Revolution. He kept the tyranny of the Stuart monarch off the throne, and with it, any papal influence. His legacy wouldn't become clear for some time either. He had defied the French and re-established the English as a Protestant force, rejecting Louis XIV, who had plied the Stuart monarchy with money for their allegiance to Versailles. The financial situation of the country had also improved with what is commonly known as the financial revolution that followed William's crowning. Gone were the times of ship tax and tonnage and poundage to raise money for wars. William established new laws and taxes with his war ministers to make fundraising for wars with France look legitimate to the public, raising a whopping £5 million each year on average. The Commission of Public Accounts was also established to monitor government spending and in turn give investors in the newly established Bank of England faith that money was being spent wisely. An important one, which feeds into a few episodes later down the line, is that the first steps towards the stock market were put together under William's reign. It's also worth mentioning a location that will come up a few times over the next few decades, Jonathan's Coffee House. This was the site of the original London Stock Exchange. Now, the more astute of you will say, well, Chris, the Royal Exchange was established in 1571 under Queen Elizabeth. That's where the trading was done. And I would say, yes, you are right. However, stockbrokers, that is the people whose jobs were to trade stocks and shares in companies, were banned from the Royal Exchange in the 1600s due to their rude and unprofessional manner. Some things never change. So they had nowhere to trade. Enter Jonathan's Coffee House, where brokers would congregate to buy and sell shares. Now, there's nothing to say that William III had anything to do with this, but he had been involved indirectly. The Dutch and the English had been at war for the majority of the second half of the 1600s, and as such, the relations were pretty icy before William took the crown. When he did, an influx of Dutch traders and merchants came with them. That meant not only overseas exotic goods piling into England, such as coffee and silk from English merchant expeditions, but also from the Dutch trading companies, who were massively outdoing their English counterparts at the time. The Dutch had been one of the most successful economic powers in the world during the 17th century, and a lot of those responsible came to do the same in England when William arrived. But now he was dead, and Anne ascended the throne on St. George's Day, April 23rd, 1702. Too unwell to walk, she was carried in an open chair beneath a canopy to Westminster Abbey, where she was crowned. And it's worth mentioning her ailments at this point. Apart from the defluxion that I mentioned earlier, she was obese by the time she was 30, and suffered with gout, an awful illness causing severe pain in limbs, and eventually the stomach and the head. There are stories of ministers visiting her at Kensington Palace, where she would be in extreme pain from gout, with her feet tied in a poultice and covered in bandages. And I mean, gout would have been painful without the medication we've got to manage it today. Sir John Brownlow, a baronet and MP for Grantham in Lincolnshire, shot himself as he couldn't take the pain of gout any longer around the time. In total, Anne had had 17 pregnancies. And it was this multitude of pregnancies that had left other damage to her body, which many physicians are still speculating on to this day. She also had a negative outlook on life, quoting from Lady Anne Somerset, "Anne saw herself as someone indelibly marked by suffering. Her letters to Sarah Churchill often ended with an allusion to her tragic history of bereavement, for she took to signing them, 'Your poor, unfortunate, faithful Morley.'" She was not the vision of majesty that England was used to, not just from her red spotty face or ailments, but also her mannerisms. She was shy. Many a state dinner would be sat in near silence between Anne and foreign diplomats and ambassadors. Sarah Churchill, who we will come back to, stated in her memoirs that she disliked visitors, reluctantly answered questions, and was even more unlikely to ask them. She was not clever or witty, and anything closely resembling this was likely to be rehearsed. Anne kept to the pleasantries about the weather and other mundanities, and this was down to the fact that she lacked the confidence in herself and didn't trust others. Despite the illness and character flaws she suffered, she had something that many monarchs hadn't had for a long time in England: a deep love and respect across the nation. She was widely accepted and liked when she came to the throne, despite her Stuart background. In Anne's first speech to Parliament, she said, "As I know in my heart to be entirely English, I can very sincerely assure you there is not anything you can expect or desire from me which I shall not be ready to do for the happiness and prosperity of England." Anne was also a fervent supporter of the High Anglican Church, as well as committing herself to routine and protocol of politics of the time. She prayed each morning before any public business, as well as sitting two long sessions of the Secret Council, later to become the Inner Cabinet, and eventually the Ministerial Cabinet that we see today. Many monarchs before and quite a few after hated these long sessions of seeing dignitaries, replying to royal correspondence, signing warrants, and receiving advice from various notables. But Anne, despite her ailments, got on with it with a monarchical sense of duty. As well as a keen interest in matters of state and politics, Anne loved the arts and was a patron for a number of theatres, poets and musicians. Over 25 pieces of music had been written and performed for Anne, including by Henry Purcell and Jeremiah Clarke. She rewarded George Frederick Handel, the composer of this podcast's theme song, with £200 per year after he composed Utrecht Te Deum and Jubilate. This was a choral piece, as were many of Handel's, to celebrate the Treaty of Utrecht, which ended the War of Spanish Succession. It premiered at a service in St. Paul's Cathedral in London. James Anderson Wynne, in his book about Anne's patronage of the arts, argues that even when artists weren't on her side, like the infamous satirists Alexander Pope and Jonathan Swift of the Scribulous Club, she still encouraged them. The love extended to her by her subjects came from both the Whigs and the Tories. Although she favoured moderate Tory politicians such as the Baron Godolphin, the Duke of Marlborough, formerly John Churchill, and the House of Commons Speaker at the time, Robert Harley, her first ministry also included many high Tories, such as the Earl of Nottingham and Earl of Rochester, known for their old traditionalist conservatism, believing that England was best ruled by the gentry, or elite, and favoured lower taxes. We'll go into more detail on these guys in another episode. After coming to the throne, Anne made her husband George the Lord High Admiral, although this was predominantly honorary. What's the point of marrying the Queen if you don't get a uniform, you know? Another important appointment was that of John Churchill, the Duke of Marlborough, as Captain General of the Army, and he was responsible for many victories over the French and Spanish forces during the War of Spanish Succession. In John Lovell's biography of Marlborough, he speaks highly of the Duke's competencies. Marlborough's place as one of the finest soldiers Britain ever produced is well deserved. He possessed the personal courage, imagination, common sense, self-control, and quick wits that mark the best battlefield commanders. He had an unerring ability to sense an enemy's weakness, and the ability to use stratagems to throw his enemy off balance. It was in the realm of strategy, however, where Marlborough really shone. As commander-in-chief of a coalition army, he had the ability to tolerate politicians, allies, and fools gladly. He also saw the potential of the recently introduced combination of flintlock and socket bayonet to restore the offensive to warfare in an age where extensive fortifications, magazines, and the defensive dominated military thinking. Marlborough's attention to logistics allowed him to break free of the bonds of the magazine system and ensured that his soldiers were fed, clothed and paid, earning him the loyalty of his troops and the nickname Corporal John. Marlborough's wife Sarah Churchill was also a close ally of Queen Anne. More than that, they were friends. They had pet names for each other from their younger years. They met when they were children in the court of King Charles II. Sarah was known as Freeman, and Anne as Morley. Sarah had been important as Anne's champion during William and Mary's reign, lobbying for funding for her and generally being company for a princess who didn't like visitors. It worked out well for Sarah and John Churchill, who were not only offered a dukedom almost straight after the coronation, but a £7,000 a year pension from Parliament and the royal coffers after some haggling from Sarah. Now, if you've seen Olivia Colman's excellent portrayal of Queen Anne in the film The Favourite, you'll be aware of the turbulent relationship between Sarah and Anne. Sarah Churchill is seen as a controlling and abusive captor of Anne, regularly insulting her and using her position to benefit her own position. Sarah was the opposite of Anne. She was attractive, ambitious, and charming. She had built her position by serving and entertaining the Queen for years and displaying fierce loyalty. Sarah certainly benefited, as well as both her and John receiving cash from the royal purse for their positions, of which she was mistress of the robes, the highest position any woman could hold in court, groom of the stole, and keeper of the privy purse, and the only woman ever to be made ranger of the Windsor Great Park. The Churchills had also been given a 2,000-acre deer park and manor of Woodstock, which the couple would later convert into the modern-day Blenheim Palace with funding from the Crown. If you're ever in Oxfordshire, I would highly recommend a visit. It's a fantastic day out. It was also, interestingly, the birthplace of a much later Prime Minister, Sir Winston Churchill. Sarah was not the only favourite. She constantly vied for attention and influence from Anne whilst being in competition with Abigail Masham, who was Sarah's cousin. Sarah lobbied Anne for the Whigs and Abigail for the Tories. The two spent much of the early 1700s smearing each other in an attempt to gain dominance. Now, there had been some rumour of romantic relationships going on between Abigail and Anne, as well as Sarah and Anne. And I don't really want to weigh in on this too much, but we'll give you a quote from Lady Anne Somerset's biography on Queen Anne. It would have been difficult for Abigail and the Queen to commit dark deeds in the night during Prince George's lifetime, as she shared a room with her husband, and in all of his illnesses, which lasted some years, she would never leave his bed. Anne was worn out by childbearing and in dreadful pain for much of the time, and in view of her manifold infirmities, it requires a strong effort of the imagination to conceive of her being brought by Abigail to a state of sensual arousal. Her feigned prudery and her strong sense of Christian morality makes it all the more unlikely her relationship with Abigail carried a carnal element. We'll pick up with the Churchills and Abigail later. In the late 1600s and early 1700s, there was a regularly used political rhetoric that the country had been robbed of its moral fibre, and this was only backed up by reports of the private lives of notable politicians and other of-the-day celebrities. Mary and then Anne's dedication to Anglicanism and the right Christian thing saw a return, at least on the face of things, to a more conservative viewpoint. This was surely echoed by the voting population in 1702, when the Tories and their rhetoric brought them a majority in the election. Anne's initial speech about Englishness and her views on the church's role in everyday Englishmen's lives blended nicely into Tory propaganda. The final result stood at 304 Tory MPs to 184 Whig MPs. The new, mostly Tory ministry would be led by Anne's friend, Lord Godolphin at the Treasury, and the Duke of Marlborough, who was looking after the army. They became known as the Dumvirs, a term used in ancient Rome for two officials holding a joint office. Another good friend, Robert Harley, didn't receive a ministerial position but was elected by MPs as the Speaker of the House, taking a key role in management of the House of Commons. It was unruly, and the ministry was an uncomfortable mix of high church Tories such as Lord Rochester and Nottingham, as we spoke about before, as well as militant Tory backbenchers and then some moderate Tories like Robert Harley. These differences in views began to pull the ministry in different directions. The Commission of Accounts became an excellent tool to discredit leading Whigs for their time in power under William, and this brought down the Earl of Rainley after discrepancies were found in his accounts as paymaster of the forces, almost £1 million of public funds gone missing. Leaving the squabbles of the Tories for a moment, we move to Scotland. As we discussed, Scotland and England had a shared monarch since 1603, when James I of England and VI of Scotland came to the throne. This didn't mean that they thought the same things or agree with each other, and in fact they really didn't. Scotland and England had separate parliaments, churches, laws and currency, even after James came to the throne. It was an unhappy merger that was left for much of the 1600s unresolved, but would come to loggerheads under Anne. The Stuarts, starting with James I, who brought the two kingdoms together, and the next few Stuart monarchs had tried relentlessly to bring the two churches together and to rule Scotland from England. The Scots took this throughout the 1600s, perhaps believing in part that Stuarts were Scottish and the legitimate monarchs of Scotland. But when the Glorious Revolution came, this changed everything for Scotland, and the two kingdoms had very different revolutions. The policy of uniting the Kirk and the Church of England was dropped, and Scotland now had to answer to a Dutchman on the English throne, although it with a Scottish-descended wife and queen by his side. As trade with the New World, now American Canada, was ramping up, Scottish merchants were heavily involved with Glasgow, Fife and Edinburgh becoming economic hubs. Scotland had been heavy traders on the continent, emerging out of the medieval system known as the Staple, as incredibly prosperous and organised. I'd recommend a deep read into the Staple and the Staple rites, which probably date back to Charlemagne of the Franks in the 8th century, as it is an incredibly interesting read. Glasgow was particularly prominent in the import of tobacco from mainland America and sugar from the West Indies, but this was curtailed by the Navigation Acts of the 1660s. These were laws brought in by English Parliament that regulated English trade and essentially froze out Scottish involvement, despite Charles II's efforts for these not to be put in place. Now, this wasn't to say that the Scottish weren't successful in trading before the Navigation Acts. Merchants had traded successfully for centuries with Europe, and by the mid-1600s, it was kind of seen as the golden age of Scottish trade. Though, by the end of the 17th century, Scotland was in a much worse state, due to, in part, the Great Famine that started in 1695. This, coupled with the pressure that England had lumped on with the Navigation Acts, meant that Scotland's economic power began to dwindle in the shadow of England's. In the 1690s, the Scottish Parliament voted to create a new trading company known as the Company of Scotland trading to Africa and the Indies. It was given complete monopoly of Scottish trade to India and Africa as well as North and South America. It aimed to create a colony which is in modern-day Panama, which is part of the thin landmass of Central America that sort of bridges North and South America together. England was completely against the idea for a number of reasons. It didn't want to provoke a reaction from Spain, who claimed that the area as part of its colony known as New Granada, especially as England was at war with France in the Nine-Year War at the time. There was also protest based on economic theory of the time known as mercantilism. You're going to hear more and more about this as we go further into the growth of international trade. In its simplest form, it was the idea that economic power was static and did not increase, which is the general belief today. It meant that if you wanted to increase your trade power as a nation, you had to take it from someone else. This policy was one of the key arguments behind colonial policies and was a big reason as to why England didn't approve of the Darien scheme, which is what the Scottish venture in Panama became known as, mainly because they feared if it were successful, it would take trade power from them. Mercantilist economic theory would lead Britain and many of the superpowers of the time pretty much exclusively until the late 1700s. The idea was to create a trading port that would allow for an overseas trade route between the Atlantic Sea, or the one between America and Europe, and the Pacific Sea, or the one between America and Asia. It was a clever idea which many countries, including Great Britain, France and Spain, had attempted and would attempt over the next 200 years, until it was materialised in 1849 with the Panama Canal Railway, which was established as an effective overland trade route. The famous Panama Canal itself wouldn't be open until 1914, despite almost constant attempts to establish it since the 1700s. The reason why it was so important was because it allowed ships to go from Asia to Panama, by sort of where that space between where Hawaii was, and then go to Europe, as opposed to having to sail the whole way around back to Europe. The Scottish began raising money for the expedition in 1696 and managed to raise a total of £400,000, which in modern money works out at just under £48 million. As we love a good conversion here on the podcast, that would buy you close to 100,000 cows, 75,000 horses, or 200 quarters of wheat. And we all know that a quarter of wheat is, of course, equivalent to 8 bushels. The first expedition set off in 1698 and reached the Central American area after a 4-month voyage, naming their new country Caledonia. They settled not far from the landing site, and this name of the colony was New Edinburgh. Long story short, a failure to trade with locals and passing traders, as well as malaria and fever, polished off the colony in under a year. Only 1 in 4 settlers survived the expedition. One ship in desperate need of help attempted to gain access to the Jamaican city of Port Royal, but on orders of the British, now in control of the city since 1655, refused to allow them in. Many who returned home were seen as failures and were even disowned by their own families, which I have to say is pretty harsh. By the time the failed expedition returned, another fleet of pioneers had already set sail to New Edinburgh with over 1,000 settlers on board. When they arrived, they found it odd that the town was completely deserted and had a pretty horrible couple of months rebuilding the settlement before they were attacked by the Spanish in early 1700. The Spanish besieged the Scots and forced a surrender after threatening to kill them all if they didn't surrender, or in the polite military way, they offered no quarter to the Scots. The Scots surrendered, well, what was left of them, because many had died from fever, and only a couple of dozen actually made it back to Scotland. And that's the Darien scheme in a nutshell. It wasn't just England's fault. There was Spanish interference and a hell of a lot of mismanagement from Scotland. It wasn't the fault that Scotland had suffered heavily from the famine, along with much of Europe in the 1690s. They were still employing feudal land practices that led to poor soil quality. It wasn't all the fault of William and the English government, but the Scottish began to feel more and more ill will towards their neighbours. Scotland had become increasingly unhappy with the control England had over their interests, with the Darien expedition being a perfect example, and this, coupled with the resentment building since the Glorious Revolution, came to a head in 1703 with the Scottish Act Anent Peace and War. In case you're wondering, anent is Scot for about or concerning. The law basically said that after Anne died, no monarch of England and Scotland could take Scotland to war without Holyrood, the Scottish Parliament, consenting to it. The Scottish were displeased about being brought into the War of Spanish Succession and concerned of the prospect of having Hanoverians, who were technically next in line to the throne, taking the throne and forcing Scotland to fight German continental wars. This was followed up by the Act of Security of 1704, which saw Scotland state that they would not accept an English Protestant successor unless a number of terms were met, including religious, economic, and political, and would instead opt to elect their own Protestant successor from the Scottish royal lineage. This would be decided by the 3 estates of Scotland, as we've spoken about before, made up of church, the nobility, and the burghers, who represented the royal burghs, or areas of the country. As Anne was still monarch of Scotland, she refused to grant the royal assent to the bill, through her representative in Scotland, the Duke of Queensberry, who held the position of Lord High Commissioner to the Parliament of Scotland. Scotland, unhappy with this, refused to raise taxes and threatened to withhold money that was meant for the War of Spanish Succession, and would significantly hamper the Duke of Marlborough's efforts on the continent. The act was begrudgingly given royal assent, but of course England was not going to take this lying down. The following year, 1705, the English Parliament passed the Alien Act. Presented to the Lords by Godolphin, it stated that Scottish nationals would be treated as aliens or foreigners if the two kingdoms split. Property would be treated as alien, meaning that Scottish sons would not necessarily inherit their father's estates, and that Scottish people would lose the rights of English men. The law placed an embargo on Scottish staple trade goods, that word again, which consisted of linens, cattle and coal, almost half of Scotland's tradable goods. It also stopped importing weapons, ammunition and horses, so it wasn't as if Scotland could raise an army to stop it. Harley and the moderate Tories were mad about Godolphin's Alien Act, which was tantamount to bullying a nation into submission and attempted to censure Godolphin, which is a formal written letter of disapproval passed in Parliament, but it failed without support of Godolphin's bloc and the Whigs. The leading figures of the Whig Party, also known as the Whig Junto, who had been deep in Scottish negotiations for a number of years, worked with Godolphin to secure the Alien Act and bring the Scottish to the negotiating table. Now, this restriction on Scottish trade was bad, and when you couple it with the residual damage left from the Darien scheme, Scotland were about to be in real financial trouble. The Darien scheme had been backed with about 20% of all money circulating in Scotland at the time. Its failure essentially crippled the lowlands of Scotland, which included cities like Glasgow, Aberdeen, and Edinburgh. I cannot put too fine a point on how important this was in what happened next. So the English basically said, yeah, it's cool, you guys do what you want to do when Anne dies, but don't think you're going to get any help from us, and we're going to make your lives pretty bad once this is all over. But there was a clause in the Alien Act that stated if Scotland entered negotiations with England about uniting as one kingdom, the Alien Act could be suspended from coming into force. And that is exactly what the Scottish did. After much manoeuvring in Holyrood, the Scottish court party gained enough support to agree to new negotiations in August 1705. The next step was who would choose the commissioners negotiating the treaty. Now, the Duke of Hamilton was a senior peer in Holyrood who had been against the treaty from the beginning, but managed to cause a ruckus in Scottish Parliament by suggesting that the Queen should appoint commissioners. In disgust, the majority of the opposition leaders left the chamber and the motion passed by only 8 votes. It is interesting that Hamilton could have secured the Scottish throne for his own family, but privately admitted that our independency is now a jest. Or in other words, to resist a union with England was a joke, much like my Scottish accent. He saw that a union would benefit Scotland more than just an agreement on trade and politics, and he was also created a commissioner and did pretty well in the next few years, so there's the matter of self-interest that keeps popping its head up. The Scottish commissioners travelled to London in April 1706 and negotiations began. Now, the negotiations weren't done in the same way that we've seen the Brexit negotiations carried out. They actually achieved something. I kid. The two delegations were set up in rooms next to each other, and responses were conducted by letter passed back and forth. It took 3 days to secure the key victories. Scotland would accept a Hanoverian monarch and would get access to English trade routes and opportunities. There were a number of other key areas that had to be decided. The Union Jack would become the flag for both kingdoms. Weights and measures were standardised, and of course, how many Scottish peers that would sit in the English Parliament needed to be decided. You can imagine the number of areas where two countries' laws had to be compared and then merged into an acceptable outcome. Taxation was an interesting one, which included a number of exemptions on goods where Scotland could not pay the same level of taxation as their English counterparts. The Scottish legal system and the rights of the royal burghs were kept in place, being seen as crucial parts of Scottish civil society. Church, specifically the Scottish Kirk, was not mentioned at all in the Acts of Union. There was a fear that Tories wanting to protect the Church of England would have blocked the Union if there were any attempts to merge or alter the Anglican approach, or more specifically, the Act of Uniformity that standardised the Book of Prayer and rites for the English Church. Once the Articles of Union had been confirmed in July 1706, the next step was getting Holyrood to approve. There was only one chamber in the Scottish Parliament, unlike England's two. There were 277 members, of which around 100 were already on board as members of the court party. The additional votes came from a group of Whig nobles known as the Squadrone, as well as the inorganisation of the opposition country party, who weren't ordered to attend and vote, and thus weren't really regular attendees of Scottish Parliament. The voting continued whilst baying mobs rioted outside, protesting against the Union. Queensberry sent troops in with the order to shoot if necessary in order to quell the protests. Almost 100 petitions or signed protests were brought to Holyrood during the deliberating period to urge members of Holyrood not to pass the Articles of Union. The Articles of Union were passed individually, and the 25th article was approved in the Scottish Parliament on the 14th of January 1707. The Act of Ratification to approve the entirety of the Articles was then passed by 110 votes to 67. The act was then touched with the royal sceptre by the Lord High Commissioner Queensberry, which was the traditional way of approving laws in Scotland. And with the wave of a sceptre, the Scottish were on board. The English took only two sessions spread across 10 days to approve 25 articles. Concerns that government was hurrying the articles through were met with sarcastic shouts from MPs in the chamber of "Post haste! Post haste!" When the bill came to the Lords, the Tories attempted to prevent it with their worries that the church was not protected, and having issues with other small parts of some of the articles. However, Godolphin's bloc, along with the Whig junto, pushed the articles through, which gained royal assent from Anne on the 6th of March 1707. Though technically it was 1706, as the Julian calendar was still in effect, that had its new year on the 25th of March. More on that in 1752 when we move over to the Gregorian calendar. Exciting stuff, I promise. As soon as the Act of Union came into effect, the Crown granted Scotland £400,000 to clear their debts accumulated from the failure of the Darien scheme. Electoral boundaries were redrawn in Scotland, and 30 members of Parliament would represent Scotland in Westminster. Scottish Parliament, Holyrood, was also closed and returned simply to being a palace where many nobles resided, including the pesky Duke of Hamilton. The news of the union between England and Scotland was much celebrated in the south. Marlborough had been making fantastic progress with victories on the continent in the War of Spanish Succession, and there was much jubilation in the capital that included a service of thanksgiving in St. Paul's Cathedral attended by Anne. Edinburgh weren't so happy, and when England, Wales and Ireland declared a day of thanksgiving on the 1st of May, Scotland decided against it. I like to think that's why we have an early May Bank holiday to celebrate the union, but sadly it's not. We've only had it since 1978. Scotland, on the other hand, have had it since the 1870s, the lucky devils. And just like that, a couple of signed pieces of paper, a few swooshes of royal sceptres and the stamping of royal seals, and the Kingdom of Great Britain was formed. We're going to leave this episode here and pick up next time with some more events in Anne's reign. It's difficult, as we'll have to look back before the Act of Union and start talking about England again to explain some of the other aspects, but don't worry, it's much easier to explain themes and areas as opposed to just doing a straight chronology. I hope you've enjoyed. I hope you're glad I'm back. I am. See you soon.